Good morning. Canada's Prime Minister confirms a new trade war with the U.S. has begun after talks collapse.
Canada will match Washington's new tariffs dollar for dollar in order to protect Canadian workers, farmers, families, and businesses.
President Trump also prepares to raise the economic pressure on Iran in ways that could hit China. And the Supreme Court delivers a temporary verdict on the White House ballroom project. It's Monday, August 24th. I'm Cecilia Lay, in for Shamita Basu, and this is Apple News Today. The U.S. and Canada are engaged in a dramatic economic standoff after a deal to lower tariffs fell apart. Officials had been locked in last-minute talks last week, hoping to set the stage for a comprehensive deal that would ultimately bring the two countries closer together. Trump appeared optimistic, preemptively declaring a deal was done last Tuesday. Instead, the talks broke down after Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney refused to accept late concessions. A range of Canadian goods now face 50% tariffs, while Canada is preparing its own tariffs on U.S. products as well. On Saturday morning, Carney addressed the nation.
Well, we believed earlier this week that we were moving towards a mutually beneficial agreement. In recent days, the United States proposed new terms that were uneconomic, unfair, and undermined the net benefits for Canada and called into question the reliability of any deal. In short, they asked too much and they offered too little.
And he pointed to a broader rupture in relations.
Early last year in this room, I observed that the decades-long process of steadily increasing integration between our economies was over. Our government understood before many that America would transform all of its commercial relationships, that it would put a series of tariffs on its closest allies and use economic integration as a weapon. We recognize that sometimes its signature was written in pencil.
In response, Trump accused Canada of seeking the benefits of being a U.S. state without actually being one. His trade representative, Jameson Greer, spoke to Fox on Saturday.
We're moving forward with measures that respond to Canadian retaliation. Remember, as President Trump has introduced a trade policy to reshore American production and protect American jobs, two countries have retaliated against the United States, the People's Republic of China and Canada.
Canada had been looking to lower tariffs on steel, aluminum, and auto parts, concessions the U.S. were seemingly reluctant to give. And Carney suggested the U.S. had made last-minute demands that would roll back efforts to promote French, an official language in Canada. David Lynch is a global economics correspondent for The Washington Post. He told us which industries would feel Trump's new tariffs.
It amounts to about 5% of the imports we get from Canada. We call it roughly $20 billion, maybe a little bit more than that, worth of merchandise. And it's everything from hockey sticks to beer to Crown Royal whiskey, some lumber products. You might look at that and say, gee, 5%. You know, who cares? That's not a lot. But it's significant, of course, if you're an American importer of one of those items, you're seeing your input costs jump 50% overnight. You know, that's literally unsustainable.
As for Canada, Carney has said that he will target sectors that include dairy, appliances, steel, and electronics.
He could have imposed these tariffs, his retaliatory measures, instantly. He didn't. He said these will take effect September 8th. So you've got a couple of weeks now. You know, there's probably at some point, if not already, people talking on the telephone or via email or back channels or industry to industry contacts feeling out, hey, how can we get off this cliff's edge that we've wandered out onto?
Lynch says the timeline for fixing this latest tit-for-tat is up in the air for now, but both sides are aware of the potential costs of a prolonged economic battle.
I think to some degree, neither side wants a complete rupture here. Whatever you think of the trade policies of the last several decades, the reality is the North American industrial economy is very highly integrated at this point. Factories here in the United States depend on Canada, depend on Mexico for inputs, and vice versa. And if we were to have a genuine, complete, lasting rupture with Canada, that would cost both sides. And so I do expect at some point, hopefully reasonably soon, they'll get back to arguing.
Later today, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will outline his plans to impose what he calls the toughest sanctions in history on Iran. Trump described it as an economic D-Day for the country, with measures that could widen to hit anyone doing business with Tehran. That could have big implications for major U.S. trading partners, including China. Bessent spoke to CNBC last week to discuss the plans.
We are going to them and saying, you are either with us or against us. You want this murderous regime to end. And if you insist on doing business with them, either transferring money, buying their oil, doing seaborne ship transfers, then the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. government, they will put its full might and force toward enforcing against you.
Farnoosh Amiri is a national security correspondent for the Associated Press.
Iran is one of the most sanctioned countries in the world, almost exclusively by the U.S. So there is very few options left as far as financial penalties that the U.S. has left to hit Iran with.
She told us any attempt to spread the economic pain to other countries would be a stunning move.
Because it has a lot of risks when you start to sanction or target countries like China and India, which are both major trading partners with Iran, but also very important financial partners with the United States. And there is a possibility that there will be a lot of backlash.
China buys roughly 90% of Iran's shipped oil. It's made its opposition to sanctions known and said the pressure won't resolve the crisis in the Middle East.
The issue is that Iran has been able to spend the past 47 years getting away with being sanctioned so heavily and being able to withstand all this U.S. pressure. And it has very rarely brought Iran to the table or has made them capitulate in any way that any previous U.S. administration has sought to do.
Iran's foreign minister said his country had, quote, seen this movie before and described the plans as desperate. But Amiri told us Iran's finances are deteriorating, squeezing an economy that was already in dire straits. Meanwhile, it has lost an important trading partner.
The UAE announced last week that they are cutting off trade with Iran. UAE is one of the really vital partners for Iran because they've been able to offset sanctions that the U.S. has put on Iran for decades. And, you know, without critical trading partners like the Emiratis or the Chinese, you know, Iran can only spiral further down.
Over the weekend, Iran's security chief delivered a warning to Gulf nations. He suggested that countries helping the U.S. push economic restrictions would be seen as an enemy. If Iran felt compelled to act against its neighbors, Amiri says that the U.S. military would have a tougher job defending them thanks to munitions shortages. At the same time, breakthrough talks seem a long ways away. Ultimately, Amiri says, the Iranian leadership continues to take pride in being able to withstand the economic pain it's going through.
They don't believe that if they were to succumb to any of this pressure and to any of the terms that the U.S. is putting out right now, that there would be an open door at the end of this.
The Supreme Court allowed President Trump to continue his White House ballroom project, at least for now, as it considers the administration's request to weigh in on a lawsuit against the project. Chief Justice John Roberts issued a temporary measure without detailing his reasoning or when a more durable decision would be handed down. Construction teams are now reportedly working nearly around the clock to complete the 90,000-square-foot project, work that could be difficult to undo, even if the lawsuit succeeds. James Remoster covers the Supreme Court for The Wall Street Journal.
I think that his strategy here is to try to have construction proceed for as long as possible before the court system issues a definitive, conclusive ruling on the legality of the project. And the reason for that strategy is the more that Trump builds, the closer this thing gets to completion, the harder it's going to be for courts to unwind it, even if they determine that the project itself is illegal.
The preservation group bringing the lawsuit claims the project violates federal law because Congress never approved it. Two lower courts ruled that it's probably illegal, but the construction has continued as the administration pursues appeals.
The ballroom is sort of the most tangible example of a legal strategy that has really defined a lot of the most aggressive actions of Trump's second term. And what I mean by that is that Trump has really shown a penchant for acting quickly, acting swiftly, taking some action that is somewhat legally questionable, and acting so fast that the courts sometimes can't really keep up.
The administration's lawyers have argued that the project is so far along that it would be impossible and unsafe to stop now.
And so they're essentially saying to the Supreme Court, regardless of what you think of the legal merits, the project must keep going because it's already two-thirds of the way done.
Trump initially said the ballroom was needed to improve the entertainment facilities.
His main rationale was that the White House needed a lavish ballroom. He said that the White House needed an event space to host large state dinners, that it would bring the country prestige. His rationale for the project and the scope of the project itself has really evolved since then.
As the project developed, the administration has pointed to national security. His team has turned to referring to the site as a military project that now includes missile-resistant columns and blast-proof glass.
So he's now framing this, and his administration and court is framing this as an urgently needed security superstructure, not just a fancy ballroom. But of course, the fancy ballroom will still be a part of the structure once it's complete.
Trump said his administration is grateful for Friday's decision, posting on social media that the project is, quote, under budget and ahead of schedule. And the Journal reports that there's a chance the construction will be completed before the court case concludes. It's estimated to be finished by September 2028. Here are a few other stories we're following today. A fast-moving wildfire that broke out Saturday in Reno, Nevada, has forced tens of thousands of people from their homes over the weekend. On Sunday, local officials announced that another 45,000 residents have been told to prepare for evacuation because of the Hawk Fire, which is burning in the northern part of the city. So far, the fire has scorched about 15,000 acres. U.S. Forest Service officials say the blaze was human-caused, and an investigation is underway. Nevada's governor has declared a state of emergency in Washoe County, which includes Reno and parts of Lake Tahoe. And the Nevada National Guard has been mobilized. Democratic House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has held a rare meeting with President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, at a private space in New York City. That's according to the New York Times, which suggested they discussed possible areas of common ground ahead of the midterms. Democrats are currently leading in the polls, and Jeffries would become the Speaker of the House if they secured a majority in November. Kushner has no formal role in the Trump administration, and critics say his unusual access to power can create conflicts of interest. White House officials and Kushner's aide did not respond to the Times' request for comment. In a statement, Jeffries did not acknowledge the meeting, but said that Democrats would only negotiate with the administration if Republicans were willing to budge on cost-of-living issues. And finally, IndyCar drivers roared through Washington, D.C. yesterday in what was the last big 250th anniversary event of the year. Upward of 150,000 people watched President Trump's so-called Freedom 250 Grand Prix, which turned the Capitol's downtown into one giant race course.
Gentlemen, start your engines!
That's Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum and Lieutenant General Lawrence G. Ferguson delivering the most famous words in motorsport. A total of 25 race cars sped around a 1.7-mile track that passed national monuments and Smithsonian museums. It was a major undertaking. The New York Times reports that more than 200 manhole covers were welded shut, and flights into Ronald Reagan National Airport were redirected. The National Gallery of Art even conducted vibration studies as a precaution for its outdoor sculptures. Trump waved the green flag to start the competition. And after circling the National Mall 147 times, American Kyle Kirkwood emerged victorious.
As the Secretary of Transportation waves the checkered flag, Kyle Kirkwood wins an American on the top step of the podium at the Freedom 250.
You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Popular Mechanics tells the history of how U.S. and German soldiers came together at the end of World War II to save rare and priceless Soviet horses. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.